And we now have joining us via phone from Chicago, Phil Huber, Chief Investment Officer at Huber Financial Advisors. Phil also has a great blog at bipsandpieces.com. Phil, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Ned. Appreciate you having me on.
All right, Phil. So just to clarify for everyone, what is the proper pronunciation for the basis points abbreviation? I saw you going back and forth on Twitter on this.
Yeah, I thought I didn't even realize that was a debate.
Me neither.
It's BIPS. Some people, I guess, go BEEPS. Some others might spell out the BPS, but yeah, it's always BIPS to me.
All right, you and I are on the same page, and it's scary to think who is using BEEPS and BPS. All right, so first, some quick backstory. You and I met at the Inside ETFs conference earlier this year, and we got to talking. Your firm uses ETFs. And I always think it's interesting to learn how different firms approach the ETF space. We actually had an ETF strategist on the podcast a few weeks ago. Maybe first start by telling us a little bit about Huber Financial Advisors, and then give us some background on your use of ETFs.
Sure. So we've been in business for just over 30 years now, and we do financial planning and investment management, and so our portfolio construction, the way we manage money for clients, is to design and build multi-asset allocation strategies that are tailored to a client's financial plan. And so we're a bit product agnostic in that sense. We don't do any in-house money management. We're not stock pickers or bond pickers, so we do use all 40 Act type products, but we use mutual funds in certain areas, ETFs in others, and interval funds in other cases. So it really just depends on the type of exposure we're trying to get. But in that sense, ETFs have certainly grown in terms of our usage of them over the years, but we still use a fair amount of mutual funds as well.
All right. So when you're looking into your portfolios, how do you decide, whether an ETF is the right investment vehicle to execute whatever it is you're trying to do? And then B, if it is, how do you determine which ETFs to use?
Sure. So I would say the areas might be easier actually to start where we don't use ETFs. So I think the quality of certain types of liquid alternative strategies is better in the mutual fund structure. And so we tend to not really use any ETFs in that bucket of the portfolio. And then we actually, in terms of the active kind of passive debate, while we're more skewed towards kind of passive and factor-based investments on the equity side, we tend to err more towards active managers on the bond side. And so while we do use a couple of bond ETFs for certain portfolios or models, we use largely institutional active management in that space. And so our primary usage of ETFs tends to be within different parts of the equity universe. From a selection standpoint, it's really, in some cases, kind of broad beta-type exposures, but generally speaking, more factor-oriented strategies.
Yeah, so on the factor-based ETFs, and we're talking momentum, value, dividend growth, those sorts of things, how do you approach this space? Because there's a lot of product out there. As you know, there's a spectrum in terms of how much factor exposure these ETFs provide. So what does your decision-making process look like around these?
Sure, yeah. So first of all, there's so many decision points that go into this, where I think a lot of people don't quite look as deep under the hood of different products, because it might just be, oh, I like this fund provider and it has, factor in the name, so that's good enough for me, and off we go. But I did a blog post on this a couple of months ago. If you take a look at the landscape of just we'll focus on multi-factor products for now. There's at least a dozen multi-factor funds out there from all the different providers. If you expand that to include mutual funds, there's a handful of other kind of quantitative, quasi-active strategies there. So if you look across that spectrum, you'll see that all of them have, a different set of factors that they blend together. Some of them do large cap stocks only, some do large, mid, small. Fees, there's quite a large range in fees. Some are a little more dynamic in how they manage factor exposures. Others are a bit more, consistent or strategic in nature. And then it gets the tracking error, too. Some, hug pretty close to the benchmark, whereas others have a bit higher tracking error and active share. So plenty of things. It really just boils down to what are you trying to achieve as an investor? What are the factors that you truly believe in? And trying to find the product that best aligns with, how you wish to invest.
You mentioned tracking error. One thing I'm curious about, Look, your firm manages nearly $1.5 billion. You have a lot on the line with your end clients. So when you're looking at factor exposure, how do you decide how concentrated or pure the exposure will be? And probably more importantly, how do you prepare end clients for that ride? Because as you know, if you invest in, let's say, a pure concentrated value ETF, there's going to be extremely high tracking error. So what are you looking for here?
Right. I think deck A gives merit to the idea of using multiple factors as opposed to one. If you're only investing in, say, the value factor, that's going to obviously give you much higher tracking error to something like the S&P. You know, I think if you're going to make the active decision to be a factor investor, you have to know going in that you have to be different than the index. And if that's not something that someone's comfortable with, then you're much better off in a beta-focused portfolio. But I think you have to be able to tolerate a healthy amount of tracking error in order to try to maximize your odds of success as a factor investor. But that also requires that, you know what's going on under the hood of the funds you own, and it requires patience and a long-term horizon, because any factor, you know, value being the case most recently, can go through a fairly significant period of underperformance. So you have to be prepared for that. At the end of the day, these are active strategies. It's a lot different than, you know, the traditional type of active management where you're hiring someone to kind of, you know, pick stocks for you on a discretionary basis, but it's still active. And so you have to be prepared for the, you know, the outcomes, good or bad.
You mentioned on the fixed income side of your portfolios, you are more likely to use actively managed strategies. And look, as a whole, I think the active versus passive debate has grown extremely tired, right? I think pretty much anything you do in an investment portfolio, there's an active element to it. But, you know, if you look at all the data, and we can debate the data, passive, you know, tends to outperform, or you could say active tends to underperform passive over the long term. So what has you looking at active strategies on the bond side of the equation?
Well, I think first and foremost, the evidence isn't quite as compelling against active management as it is with equities. I think once you do some just initial screens for, like, we only use institutional share classes, so that screen alone off the bat, I think, improves your odds of success. When we do use a handful of managers too, we're not betting everything on one, you know, intermediate core manager. So I think you get some manager diversification as well. But at the end of the day, it's not a guarantee. We think there's flaws in the way that traditional bond indexes are constructed. So there's a number of reasons that go into it. There's a large presence of non-economic participants in bond markets. That might not be motivated purely by profit maximization. And so a lot of different factors. There's been some good research put out by PIMCO and Guggenheim and a few others just on this idea of why bonds are a bit different than stocks in terms of the active-passive debate. But, you know, I think, you know, there's certainly, you're starting to see some sparks of innovation in ETFs with kind of more systematic approaches to fixed income, trying to do kind of what's been done in equities over the past, you know, 5-10 years. But, you know, I think the jury's still out in that sense.
You mentioned innovation in ETFs. Any thoughts on new ETFs? Because there's a lot of debate in the ETF industry right now about whether there are barriers to new ETFs getting off the ground. So I'm just curious, as you look at your ETF due diligence process, do you have AUM screens, liquidity screens, anything else? How do you approach new ETFs?
Sure. I there's no hard and fast numbers that we have. But that being said, you know, we're not going to probably jump right into a brand new ETF that's got, you know, $5 million in it. Just given the type of business we have, and, you know, we're always managing cash flow. So we need to be able to kind of trade and, you know, operate and manage our portfolios, you know, relatively efficiently. And so it would be pretty rare for us to just kind of be a kind of seed investor or kind of day one investor in a new ETF. So we would like to see some level of traction. But, you know, it doesn't have to be a $1 billion fund for us to participate. We just want to make sure that we can, you know, effectively trade it and, you know, and then that it fits with what we're trying to do inside the portfolio.
Phil, this is Jason Lenk. On that subject of the size of an ETF, your firm has enjoyed a lot of success. Is there any difference in the way you approach ETF selection or investment selection when you manage $500 million versus a billion and a half? Does your process change at all?
It's hard to say because, you know, when we, I would say the growth of ETFs in our portfolios has really largely taken place in the past, you know, call it 3 to 5 years. And so when we were $500 million in assets under management, it was still almost exclusively mutual fund-based. So it's hard to say. I would imagine not a great deal would be different. You know, at the end of the day, the types of ETFs we're selecting are not the very narrow, niche-y type of products to begin with. And so generally speaking, you know, the size or liquidity of the ETFs that are kind of in our universe, it's generally not a huge concern to us because they tend to be, you know, of decent enough size.
Phil, obviously ETF fees continue making a lot of headlines. What role does cost play in your selection process? And I guess along with that, commission-free ETFs.
Sure. So I guess I'll tackle the free side in terms of expense ratio first. I think investors should always be wary of anything that's being offered is free. You know, if the product is free, then you're the product. I think the shift that we've seen from like 1% plus in just getting large cap, you know, U.S. stock exposure down to, you know, 20 basis points, that was the big deal. I think this haggling over 1 or 2 basis points and the kind of fee wars you're seeing where, you know, the different beta providers are putting out ads in Barron's and elsewhere about, well, we now have the cheapest large cap equity ETF at 4 basis points, and now it's 3 basis points. It's, at the end of the day, you're kind of splitting hairs when it gets down to that, when you're just fighting over 1 or 2 basis points. And there's, you know, at the end of the day, obviously all else equal, cheaper is better, but all else is rarely equal. You know, an analogy I was thinking of was, you know, if somebody offered to babysit your kids for free, you probably wouldn't just respond with, when can you start?
Right.
You want to do a little bit more due diligence,
yeah.
Probably some, you know, background checks and references and things like that. So, you know, I think, you know, it might be a bit gimmicky, the whole, oh, we're offering this ETF for free. That being said, the commission-free ETF side of things, as a operator and someone who's trying to, you know, manage portfolios for, you know, call it roughly 1,000 households that have continual deposits and withdrawals, having access to a broad menu of, you know, commission-free trading ETFs there's value to that for us just operationally. So I think that's a plus. I mean, at the end of the day, even if ETFs aren't commission-free, they're, you know, we use Schwab as our custodian. It's $4.95 a trade. It's, I mean, relative to 10, 20 years ago, that's extremely cheap to trade, whether it's commission or commission-free on the trade. But, you know, it certainly kind of smooths out things a little bit, you know, having those commission-free options. And certainly Schwab, you know, expanded their platform a great deal earlier this year from 200-something, you know, commission-free ETFs to over 500. But that being said, you don't have to be commission-free to be a part of our lineup.
Our guest is Phil Huber, Chief Investment Officer at Huber Financial Advisors. All right, Phil, with the remaining time we have, I have to put you through our rapid-fire Q&A. We've got about 5 minutes here, so hopefully we can have some fun with these. I tend to keep these ETF-focused, but I'm going to toss in a couple of more general investing questions for you as well. So if you're ready, I'm just going to start firing away here.
Yeah, fire away. This should be fun.
Okay, so first, my standard question that everyone gets, should a Bitcoin ETF exist? And if it did, would you consider it for a portfolio?
So it's hard for me to say an ETF should or shouldn't exist. There's probably plenty of ETFs that already exist that, in my mind, you know, there's really not a need for. But, you know, that's the beauty of ETFs. Anyone's free to launch one. And as a consumer, you don't have to buy them if you don't like them. So I think it's an inevitability that there will be a Bitcoin ETF eventually. As to whether we would buy it for clients, I would say it's highly unlikely. But, you know, never say never.
Fair enough. All right, another standard question, your favorite ETF ticker symbol. And by the way, I have to mention, a while back, Tadas Viscanta asked several people, including you, what ETF, if it were launched tomorrow, would you invest in? And I got a huge kick out of this. You responded with the inverse Gartman ETF. This was obviously tongue-in-cheek, but the ticker symbol you proposed was fantastic. It was wrong, WRNG. I just love that. So what is your favorite ticker symbol for an ETF that currently exists?
Oh man, so I gave way more thought to this question than I probably should have. So I think there's two camps of great ETF tickers. I think there's the, call it more gimmicky tickers, you know, the Moo and the, you know, other ones like that, where it's kind of a word that's, you know, associated with the fund itself, and it's kind of fun to say. But then I think there's another camp where, you know, so I'll give an example, like something like QVAL from Alpha Architect. It's one of those ones, got two syllables, it kind of tells you a little bit about the strategy, quantitative value, and it just rolls off the tongue nicely. Like, it's just, you know, easy to say. I think the tougher tickers are the ones that you have to spell out completely, like, say, like GLD, like, you got to say GLD. I like, you know, QVAL, you're just like QVAL. Another one, like, in that vein would be Aggie from WisdomTree. It's a yield-enhanced aggregate bond ETF. It's just kind of a fun one to say, Aggie. But I think if I had to pick one as the greatest ticker of all time, I would have to go with GOAT from VanEck. They had their moat suite of ETFs, which obviously moat itself is a great ticker for the U.S. one, but then they came out with the global moat, I think it was last year, and that's got the ticker GOAT, so that might be my favorite.
I agree. I like that one from last year. I've mentioned this before. My favorite ticker symbol is still Moo, so I'm waiting for somebody to beat that, though we saw the UFO ETF launch recently, so that's pretty good as well.
Yeah, that's right. Pretty fun.
So next question, and you already touched on this quite a bit, but I'll still ask you. So back in March, Salt Financial filed for the first negative fee ETF, and at the time, you tweeted, quote, still holding out for the ETF that will pay me in cash, preferably non-sequential unmarked bills, neatly packaged in a large duffel bag and drop at an undisclosed location of my choosing. I don't know how you come up with this stuff, but negative ETF, gimmick or good for investors?
I think gimmick, but then ask me again if someone's offering to pay me 1% to hold their ETF, and maybe I'll listen.
All right. On a bit of a more serious note, in your opinion, what is the single most important factor to long-term investing success?
This is going to sound probably cliche, and I'm sure it's an answer you've gotten, you know, before, but I think at the end of the day, the biggest factor is the one that stares us in the mirror every day. It's our own behavior. So as an investment advisor, you know, I look at our job as twofold. I think it's, I don't want to downplay the importance of, you know, choosing great investments and building great portfolios, but I think it's also equally, if not more important, that we spend time trying to cultivate great investors. And that comes through just regular communication and education efforts with your clients, you know, taking the, you know, news and different events that are happening each day that might frighten clients and derail their plans and their portfolios, and trying to use history, you know, set expectations, provide context, all those things. You want to make sure your clients really understand what you're doing and why you're doing it when it comes to managing their money, and not just, you know, sort of assume that they understand what it is. You can't be transparent enough or, you know, communicate enough with clients, is my opinion. So that's, you know, a big reason why I do the blog or I'm active on social media, is to help just spread our philosophy, you know, spread our thoughts and opinions on different investment-related topics.
I love that answer. I mean, it really boils down to behavior and education, and the education piece helps the behavior. All right, last question. There's been a lot of discussion recently around advisor fees. So we saw Schwab's Robo CFP service come out with a subscription-based model a few weeks ago. Do you have any strong opinions on what the right fee model is, or at least how investors should think about advisor fees?
It kind of reminds me of that quote, democracy is the worst form of government, except for all the others. I think, you know, so we charge AUM-based fees for our clients, and those scale down as assets grow, so it's a tiered fee schedule. So I love seeing innovation in terms of how, you know, advisors are thinking about charging for their services, and I don't think there's a perfect fee model out there. You know, people, you know, will point out the flaws in AUM-based fees, but I think there's, you know, you can always pick apart or find some kind of flaw in any type of fee arrangement. I think at the end of the day, we're confident that in the quality of the work we do and the value we're providing is well in excess of the fees that we charge clients. I think when I look at the skill and the expertise and the care that our team exercises with clients every day, the breadth of our service offerings, you know, above and beyond just, you know, managing a portfolio, I'm very, very confident that we're just giving an experience to clients that they can't get off the shelf at a discounted rate, whether that be in an AUM, a cheaper AUM model, or some other subscription-based or, you know, kind of retainer-type model. So, you know, I don't want to come across as dogmatic in my thinking of, you know, AUM-based fees. We're always open to, you know, exploring new ideas and keeping an open mind. But to date, nothing's been compelling enough for us to feel like we need to, you know, warrant shifting how we charge our fees.
Well, Phil, we'll have to leave it there. This was a lot of fun. We'll certainly have to do this again. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Nate. I really appreciate it. This was fun.
That was Phil Huber, Chief Investment Officer at Huber Financial Advisors. And I should mention, Phil is a great follow on Twitter. He's at Bips and Pieces. That's BPS and Pieces.